Thanks, Robert, for that introduction. No, thanks very much for having me, and for everybody to come and sort of, you know, before the semester's actually started. It's a nice opportunity to come and talk about some of my research. So this paper, it's called It Is What It Is, which will become a bit more explanatory as I go on. But it's about myth-making and identity formation on a Christian Zionist tour of Israel. And it's derived from some fieldwork that I undertook in 2012 on what was a 13-day tour of Israel with, it's often referred to as a non-denominational or charismatic megachurch, sort of evangelical Protestants. And the church was from Colorado in the USA. An additional part of this tour, which I think is important just as a kind of background, is that it was part of a much larger gathering in Israel of churches that are part of an organization called Christians United for Israel. And this is a lobby group that was established in the U.S. in 2006. And it describes itself as the sort of Christian version of AIPAC, which is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, I think. Should know that, but it's a pro sort of pro-Israel Christian lobby group, and they kind of bill themselves as they've got over 2 million members or claim to. I believe I would probably be counted in that membership as well because I've signed up to their email groups, not due to a personal affiliation, but as part of my research. So what that means is sort of unclear, but they're quite big. They do have kind of over 40 pro-Israel events every month, and once a year they meet in Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress on behalf of Israel. And this tour came at every 2 years they go to Israel for what's called the Jerusalem Summit, and they do a kind of general tour of Israel, but also engage in sort of solidarity activities. So this is a photo I took of our march down Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem. We had a speech from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, those kinds of things. So they're a political group, but and what I'll kind of try and demonstrate a little bit today is that they describe their politics not as politics, but as sort of acts of religious devotion. And so that was a big part of what my PhD thesis was on, was examining the way that they reconstitute these political acts as kind of acts of religious devotion, reenacting biblical typology, that kind of thing. Okay, so in terms of this paper, which I guess I should just sort of say, I'm working on it as a chapter for an edited collection of essays, which is on the subject of myth-making and Christian tourist attractions. So my particular tourist attraction being the modern state of Israel. Now, in terms of the kind of theoretical or methodological approach that I'm taking, there are, of course, many that one can take when writing about these kinds of things. But to give you sort of a sense of how I'm approaching this material, I would say that it's sort of a broadly social constructivist approach. And in particular, one of the frameworks that sort of underlies what I'm working on throughout this paper is taken from William Arnell and Russell McCutcheon's recent book and what they call economies of signification. And so this idea of economies of signification, as I understand it, and at least the way that I'm using it, is really based around analyzing the way that others make certain classificatory choices and distinctions between certain things, and then often represent them as simply natural or given distinctions. And at the same time, I'm sort of keeping an eye on the implications of the way that these distinctions are being made. So some fairly basic examples would be something being religious rather than political, authentic versus fake, sacred versus profane, etc. And so that kind of lines up with the social constructivist approach that I'm taking, which is to show that there's nothing sort of inherent within these descriptions, but they are sort of value-laden, and how that kind of works out. So what I'm really focusing on is how arbitrary observations are classified in particular ways by the pastors and tour guides of these groups that legitimize and naturalize their social and political interests. And so that's kind of specific aspect of this paper. But additionally, I'm trying to make the paper's data, I guess you could say, applicable to more broadly in the study of religion. So I see it as a kind of useful heuristic that I hope will contribute to some of the broader discussions that are currently animating the academic study of religion around issues of classification and what's often referred to as the politics of the category religion, so applying this category to certain activities and the significance that that has, whilst also denying it from others. And so to do this, there's kind of two examples that I'll focus on in this paper. And I think they illustrate my points relatively nicely. The first one focuses on the way that arbitrary aspects of the land are drawn upon to naturalize Israeli presence in disputed territories, and the way that this is said to sort of exemplify what are said to be God's obvious blessings bestowed upon both Israelis and Palestinians in areas that are controlled by Israel. And I sort of argue that this tends to elevate Israel's contested political project to a realm of piety or divine design. Or in a sense, you can use Roland Barthes' description of myth. I basically consider the way that the pastors and tour guides transform history into nature. And so this relates to the myth-making aspect of the paper's title. And the second example that I discuss relates to identity formation. And I show how the identity of the group with whom I traveled was constituted as more authentically Christian through the differing ways in which traditionally Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Christian sites were discussed by the pastors and tour guides. So overall, my argument, or what I'm basically trying to demonstrate through working on this paper, is that these discursive practices tend to reflect, produce, and naturalize certain normative ideas about Israel and Christianity. And these ideas, I think, are sort of essential for a broader social contest that this group is engaged in, which is a contest over what counts as authentic Christianity, what it means to be a real Christian, etc. And for them, to be a real Christian is to sort of be quite a conservative Zionist as well. So before I sort of get straight into those examples, though, I think it would be fairly helpful to give a brief word on Christian Zionism and some of the theological ideas that are prevalent among Christian Zionists. So to give a sense of why some of these particular classifications that I'll be talking about are persuasive to those hearing them in the first place. So Christian Zionism, very broadly, is a modern concept that's often used to describe a subset of evangelicals for whom the modern state of Israel and its Jewish inhabitants represent important theological and often eschatological significance. And sort of in short, Israel and its Jewish citizens tend to represent a sign that God remains active in the world. So for many Christian Zionists, travel to Israel is as much about, we might say, walking in Jesus' steps, which I think is often something that many Christians are fascinated with. But it's also very much about asserting their solidarity for Jews and the modern state of Israel. And as they see it, through that solidarity, they are paying homage to the God of Israel, and also witnessing and taking part in what they assert is his ongoing kind of active role in the world. And they get to take a part in that as well. So again, as I sort of said, there's that distinction of turning what's obviously very political into an act of religious devotion. So perhaps another way of putting this is to say that although they're interested in the past and the kind of biblical history of Israel, they are equally, if not more, interested in modern political Israel, precisely because its sheer existence as a Jewish state is demonstrative for them of the ongoing validity of the Bible, that God keeps his word both to Jews and therefore to Christians. And it's also a site in terms of those that are interested in eschatology. It's also seen as a site where the Bible is going to conclude. And so just as a sort of example of how Israel and its Jewish citizens can represent a sign, this is the cover of the kind of itinerary that was sent out to all the tour participants that I was on. And so above is a quote from the book of Isaiah. It says, "The time is coming when my people will take root. Israel will bud and blossom and fill the whole earth with her fruit." And then below is contrasted an Israel persimmon in a modern supermarket, presumably in the U.S. because it's in pounds. And so this becomes a kind of demonstrative ontological proof that God remains active in the world. This is Israel's fruit. It is filling the world, and here we have it. So again, it's just sort of little things like this that often get picked up on and understood as, again, God's activity as ongoing. Okay, so another sort of important element, I think, to kind of scaffold what I'm talking about, though, is what I call the rhetoric of blessing. And so, as I mentioned it a minute ago, for Christian Zionist travel to Israel is much about walking in Jesus' steps as it is about asserting this solidarity for Jews, and therefore paying homage to God. And so one way that this is demonstrated, as I said, is sort of through this rhetoric of blessing that surrounds a lot of Christian Zionist discourse on Israel, which is authorized primarily by two scriptural references. One comes from Genesis 12:3, where it states, "I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." And so in a Christian Zionist reading, this represents an eternal truth, which means that those who bless Jews in Israel today tend to be blessed in return, whether financially or health-wise. Again, this sort of depends on the type of Christianity one might belong to. So if people are interested in things like the prosperity gospel, that kind of thing that emphasizes health and wealth, then this becomes another source of receiving benefits in one's personal life. But essentially it means that those who bless Jews today, Jews or Israel, are blessed in return, and conversely those who curse Israel are cursed by God in return. And a second scriptural source comes from the book of Romans, and this is emphasized particularly in relation to the necessity of Christians to bless Israel. And so in Romans, Paul writes, "They were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles have shared in the Jews' spiritual blessings, they owe it to the Jews to share with them their material blessings." And so this is primarily emphasized in relation to the fact that Jesus was Jewish and therefore has given Gentiles salvation, and therefore contemporary Christians need to provide some material blessings for Jews in return. And so just as an example, CUFI on campus is the sort of campus wing of Christians United for Israel. And this is just a screenshot from their Facebook page in approaching Christmas a couple years ago now. But they just wrote, "As Christmas approaches, think about what God has given us through the Jews, Jesus, the prophets, Scripture. Think about what Israel has given the world, cell phone technology, computer software, medical aid. Think about what you can give to bless the Jewish people, whether it's donating to CUFI, signing the Israel Pledge, or just sharing the status. Quote, we owe it to the Jews to share material blessings." And then it has the Romans 15:27 scriptural reference. So there's this kind of emphasis on both historical blessings that have been given through the Jews, such as Jesus, the prophets, Scripture, etc., but also contemporary things like cell phone technology and drip irrigation and all these other kinds of things that Israel tends to excel in terms of technology. And those, again, are kind of held up as this kind of ontological proof that the scripture remains true. So what constitutes blessing for Christian Zionists, then, is not always uniform, but it is generally associated with material support for Israel, particularly financial donations, political lobbying in the U.S., supporting Israeli settlements, and simply traveling to Israel, spending money there. So this is seen, again, as sort of not only a holiday. I don't think that the participants would describe it as a pilgrimage so much as kind of a tour, but it's not just something that they get to go and enjoy and sort of be part of God's activity, but they're also very interested in contributing to the Israeli economy as a kind of a way of supporting God and supporting Israel. And just as a kind of anecdote, because this really stuck out to me, was the degree to which this is really considered by at least the organizers of these trips. So in the packet that was sent out to us, that was kind of preparing the participants for what to bring, what to have, etc., they emphasized that you should try and avoid using credit cards as much as possible because of the sort of 1% or 2% surcharge that would be used or that would be charged to the shop owners, and therefore the blessing would actually be smaller to the shop owners because they're not receiving the full amount. So try and bring cash is what they sort of said. So it was just kind of an interesting way of really the minutia in which these ideas are thought about at times. Okay, so on the other hand, though, to curse Israel is often construed as either being overtly hostile to the Zionist project, or more simply, the absence of the activities just mentioned. So a particularly potent form of cursing, though, is a support for a two-state solution, particularly one that would require Israel to cede control over East Jerusalem and areas of the West Bank. And so I've written about this in an earlier article that's in Culture and Religion, if you're interested, just as notions of America's flourishing and its role as a superpower after World War II are often related to it being the first modern nation to recognize Israel's Declaration of Independence and its kind of ongoing support for the State of Israel. Any setbacks that America might face, whether it's economically or militarily, can often be causally linked either to some real or kind of imagined shift in its relationship with Israel. So most recently, John Hagee, who is the founder and chairman of the lobby group Christians United for Israel that I studied, announced that reports of the Ebola virus in the U.S. were sort of, again, demonstrable proof that God intended to punish America for Obama's attempt to, quote, divide Jerusalem. So any sort of negative thing can generally be causally linked. I think a couple years ago when there was that volcanic ash in Iceland that was blocking all these flights out of the U.K., Hagee made similar remarks suggesting that the U.K.'s sort of reticence to support Israel 100% had caused this kind of divine punishment. Okay, so this is all kind of, again, scaffolding, kind of background. So what does this rhetoric of blessing have to do with this tour of Israel? So as I kind of saw it, for those that are persuaded by the use of this particular religious rhetoric and these particular readings of the Bible, the reality of Israeli occupation is able to be naturalized and stripped of any political or historical context, which renders it no longer political at all, but rather not only an inherently good thing, but a natural one that represents the ongoing reality of God's work in the world. And so for those receptive to these kinds of representations, my argument is that reclassifying them as religious helps to make them beyond human reproach. And one way this is done was through the particular guiding practices of the pastor of the church I was traveling with and also of the tour guide and the way some very kind of mundane visual elements of the land were picked up upon. All right, so here we sort of arrive at the myth-making portion of the paper. And my sort of, just to kind of give you a sense of how I'm using this idea of myth, and arguing that the guiding narratives are a type of mythic discourse, is primarily taken from Bruce Lincoln's work on theorizing myth, which he describes myth as ideology and narrative form. And again, Roland Barthes' idea of myth as an ideological mode of discourse that transforms history into nature. And so one way that the pastors and guides on my tour asserted the ongoing visibility of God's covenantal relationship with Israel was through their observations of the land. So I think it was quite useful because you can't really argue with what the land does. It's a natural part of the environment as well. But in a sense, by seizing upon natural aspects of the land, certain ideological positions were able to be transformed into naturalized observations, as opposed to assertions, again, about God's ongoing work in the world. And so in this way, arbitrary physical aspects of the landscape became focal points from which to extrapolate these representations of good and evil, darkness and light, and blessings and curses. So again, this emphasis on blessing and its inverse of cursing was able to be represented through the way that these landscapes were kind of described. And so on one occasion, when we were driving toward the Jordan River for members of the group to be baptized, our Israeli tour guide was sort of explaining some of the recent history of Israel, recent being its entire modern existence, so not biblical Israel, and the history of the Green Line, in more or less ordinary kind of political terms. The Green Line was the line that was drawn up after the 1948 armistice lines, etc. But after he did, one of the pastors took the microphone at the front of the bus to explain what she asserted was the Green Line's true etymology. And so this, you'll notice, is where part of the title of this paper comes from. So apologies, this is a fairly extended quote, but I think it's worth kind of hearing in full. So she states, quote, "What our tour guide didn't talk about, but what I want to explain to you, is why they call it the Green Line. And this, it is what it is. Prior to Israel's influence in Judea and Samaria," aside, that's another important classificatory distinction, "literally, the Green Line meant, and it was physical, you could see it. West of the Green Line, it was green. East of the Green Line, it wasn't so green. And that's just a fact. After the Jews began to come back to Judea and Samaria, one of the wonderful things that began to happen is that they began to share with their Arab neighbors agricultural breakthroughs and drip irrigation and all the kinds of things that Israel had learned, and it really improved their life a lot. In fact, if you look, when we get down to the Jordan River, you literally can see across the Jordan patches of green, and then it's not so green, because Israeli farmers are talking to their Jordanian neighbors about how to farm, and it's really improved their lives. You know, that's the truth that the world media misses in a great way. It doesn't talk about, but it is a fact. So I think it is important for you to know why it is called a green line," end quote. So as I sort of read this and heard this, this pastor's re-description of the Green Line very clearly diverts its original terminology away from the very ordinary origins of its name, derived from the color of the ink used to draw up the boundaries of the 1949 armistice lines, toward a much more extraordinary geographical marker of God's beneficence to those who accept his will and thus accept the presence of an expanded Israel. So that is to say, the presence of Israelis in all areas of Israel-Palestine becomes reclassified as a blessing. It's no longer occupation or human imposition, but rather God's will, which brings with it the purported improvement in the lives of Arab residents who accept it as well. And this was often contrasted with sort of the less aesthetically pleasing sites we were alerted to in Palestinian territories, which could then kind of be linked directly to those residents' unwillingness to warmly accept Israeli presence and therefore their inability to tap into the so-called divine resources that come with it. So again, these kinds of classificatory distinctions, I think, have particular implications for the way in which this information is presented to the group, and the way in which ordinary historical happenings become reconstituted as manifestations of God's work in the world, or simply the way things are, and thus become protected from any kind of critical scrutiny. So in thinking about the absence of Israeli control in areas that appeared to lack the outward outward appearance of agricultural ingenuity, I've only really touched on one example. I've got quite a few more in the actual paper. In contrast to Israeli territory and other areas where Israel had exerted some influence, which was often lush and green, which I think in reality has more to do with control over water resources than anything else, the purported blessings that come from Israeli presence then become transformed into a kind of common sense, visible fact. So again, this seems to me quite a clear representation of both Lincoln and Barth's notions of myth, whether it's ideology and narrative form, the way they're describing these things, or simply as a mode of discourse that transform all of these kind of messy histories into just simply the way things are and the way things ought to be. Again, sort of evidence in the pastor's particular description of the Green Line and her casual preface. It is what it is. So in this instance, as well as others that I haven't had time to go over today, again, Israeli presence is recast as bringing God's blessings, and thus a clear affirmation of the presence of a God who keeps his word and remains active in the affairs of humanity. And so what I argue in the paper a bit more forcefully is that one effect of wrapping descriptions of the land in religious or ahistorical language is that it helps to maintain and reinforce the dominant social structure of contested political spaces and control over land and resources in Israel, while at the same time transforming them into an apolitical, natural, or common sense reality. So that's the kind of myth-making component of this paper. And just lastly, the next part is sort of more on the way that authentic, our group was constituted as more authentically Christian. And in a sense, while the descriptions of the land tended to reinforce a particular reading of the Bible and naturalized Israel's political project, as a visible and accurate manifestation of their assertion of God's will, the guiding practices that surrounded what might be considered more traditionally Christian sites became ways to contest those identities and authorize Christian Zionists' identities as more authentically Christian. And so to kind of demonstrate this, I focus on the way that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was described and how we were kind of taken through it versus the way that the Garden Tomb is described. And this was kind of a collaboration between our tour guide and the pastors as well. So our tour guide, he's an Israeli tour guide that's studied with the Israeli Ministry of Tourism, and I think has been guiding this church for over 20 years, they said. So he knows who he's talking to and how to describe particular things. And so it was interesting to sort of see the way that he and the pastors kind of collaborated in constructing these ideas about different places. So for Catholics and Eastern Orthodox, generally the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is often said to be the site of Jesus' crucifixion and burial, and is thus considered a sacred site. And Protestants generally contest this. So when our group visited, it became a useful site upon which identities could be both contested and constructed. So prefacing our visit was the oft-repeated refrain from our tour guide that, although the Catholics believe that Jesus was crucified there, there is no evidence for it. And thus, whenever the church was discussed, it was always generally in relation to the other purportedly more authentic site of Jesus' crucifixion and burial. And so, as our guide sort of explained at one point, quote, "We are going to end the tour of Israel in one of the most peaceful and nicest places in Jerusalem, the Garden Tomb. And you will feel the presence of God. You will feel something there when you are in that important place." And later on, while we were in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, he again directed us to the ordinariness of the church when compared to the extraordinariness of the Garden Tomb. So he said, "At the end of the 19th century, they found the Garden Tomb. And when you will be there, you will have the feeling that the tomb is not here in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The tomb is there. And the place where Jesus was crucified is not here, it was there. We are coming to see this place just to let you know. And you will see the difference when you hear over there what you see there. You feel much stronger feelings there." So this was just a kind of quick pass through, just to let you know this is here and other people worship this place for some reason. But again, so these kind of, I think these brief examples tend to help demonstrate the significance of classification and make the point that there is nothing inherently special about any of these places, but rather that their specialness is always rhetorically constructed in comparison to some other place that is said to be mundane. So our guide's frequent appeal to the feelings participants would have at the Garden Tomb and our ability to feel the presence of God there, to me were significant because they primed participants to have such feelings. And admittedly, I felt a lot warmer when we were at the Garden Tomb having communion, kind of sitting down together as well, because we weren't sort of being shuttled through anything. So, you know, I can kind of understand that point, and I don't think that these people are just, you know, fools or whatever, but this is part of the whole process, the kind of language game that's going on, I guess. So even when we did go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, our pastor loudly refused to even go inside. And I think this choice really further kind of conveyed the message that this place was entirely unimportant. She only reluctantly came in order to hurry us out because, as she put it, quote, "we are wasting too much time there." So while we're sitting in the Garden Tomb, she once again used the church, as well as the common Protestant notion that Catholics worship things, rather than God, as a way to constitute our group as more authentic worshipers in opposition to Catholics. So she said, quote, "And Jesus Christ came as the perfect Lamb of God, fulfilling over 360 prophecies. And on that cross, he gave his life for you and for me. And that's what we're all about here, not to worship the place, but to honor the Savior." So, according to our pastor, then, rather than worshiping the place, such as Catholics were implied to do, we were, in fact, having a much more authentic experience with God in the actual place where Jesus was crucified and buried, the sense of which had been usefully established through the disparate treatment of the two places by the group's pastor as well as our tour guide. So, to quickly conclude, what I'm sort of arguing, what I'm trying to work through on this paper, is to really think about the way that these guiding practices, narratives, and anecdotes from the pastors and our Israeli tour guide on this trip can be analyzed as a type of mythical discourse. And so as a form of mythical discourse, it can rhetorically reconstitute seemingly ordinary things as extraordinary, as in the case with the pastor's observations about the land. Alternatively, those things which are claimed to be extraordinary by others can also be rendered wholly ordinary, and in the process serve to construct an opposing identity as more authentic, such as the case of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in contrast to the Garden Tomb. And so as I see it, I guess what interests me is that, you know, through studying these economies of signification, we can really see how categories like religion or things often associated with it can be used as tools to naturalize contested social orders and identities in ways that convey them as simply the way things are. Thank you.